papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where we try to talk to you about what's going on in news coverage these days with some veteran journalists. I'm Rex Smith here with my colleagues. I am the former editor of the Times Union, and now I write Substack, which you all know about Substack. It's called The Upstate American. I am here with Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo and Miles Reed. So, Judy, former editor of the Daily Gazette, what do you want to talk about today?
You know, I've spent the last couple of days really thinking about this new book called Original Sin about former President Joe Biden's infirmity in the last couple of years of his presidency. And, you know, all sorts of journalistic questions. Did we get snookered? Should they have written it? And so there's lots for us to mine there, I think.
Yeah, there is. Absolutely. Okay, we'll get to the Biden book. Barbara Lombardo, what's in your mind this morning?
Well, I was happy to hear from a leader from America, one of the most powerful people in the world, to be talking about the precious gift of free speech and of the press. Hmm. It happened to be Pope Leo.
Ah, right. The Pope speaking of the press. What a great thing. Imagine that.
Yes. Just recognizing its importance and speaking about journalists around the world who are imprisoned. So that's a consciousness that was very welcome.
Yeah. We don't hear that a lot from a great American leader. Miles Reed, editor of the Daily Gazette. What's on your mind?
I'm just buoyed by a big piece of breaking news that we had yesterday, where there was a court decision in state Supreme Court in Schenectady County that made a very monumental change in a long simmering civil litigation case where the pensioners at St. Clair's Hospital have been suing the diocese, the Roman Catholic diocese, to try to get their pensions back. And there was a huge decision. And after years of us covering it, I think it's vindication that we were right to stick with it. There were times when we were the only media covering it. And, you know, we are the Schenectady-based newspaper where the hospital is. So it was our responsibility. But it's an interesting development.
Yeah. When a local news organization really stays on a story and sticks with it, and you finally are vindicated by what turns out years later, it's a big deal. Yeah, I think it's a really interesting topic. And I'm interested in this new Pew Research Center survey about how Americans decide what news means to them and how it fits into their lives in the digital era. And I say it comes against this backdrop, which we've talked about in this show before. Almost 9 in 10 Americans say that they at least sometimes get news from a digital device. And 57% say that they often get news from a smartphone, a computer, or a tablet. And that is what's changed a lot over the years. And we've charted that in this program over these decades. Only about a third of Americans now often get news from TV. And print, you know, which we all have been a part of, forget about it. When I started the news business a half century ago, 85% of Americans read a newspaper, a daily newspaper. And now just a quarter of U.S. adults say, yeah, I sometimes get news from something that's in print. Now, mind you, a lot of folks don't realize that what they're reading online may have come from, say, the Times Union or the Daily Gazette. But even so, here's the thing that this new study reveals. It's no longer people with jobs like ours in this room. It's no longer editors or producers who decide what news is. Those of us who used to be considered the gatekeepers, now it's individuals who decide what's news. So definitely stories about politics and war, for example, are viewed as news, according to this new study. But people say they distinguish between news and entertainment and opinion. And I was struck by the fact that people say they want factual, up-to-date stories. They don't want it to be biased and opinionated. And yet more than half say that it's at least somewhat important that their news sources share their political views. So while there's some disconnect there, here's what's encouraging. People say that they don't always like the news, but they know they need it. So the fundamental task confronting news organizations these days is this, I think, to make sure that there's enough financial support so that journalists can continue to produce the news because people still need it. I mean, I guess that's kind of encouraging, right? We're still, they still need us. As I think, Miles, your story emphasizes, here's this big ruling that the diocese is attempting to avoid paying pensions because they say we don't have the money. And the judge is saying this is a matter. There is litigation here that deserves to be heard.
And as I said, I have vindication in that, you know, other media did cover it, but I'd argue that nobody covered it as much as we did. And at the time, in early stages of 2018, 2019, when it was starting to unfold, it felt a lot of times that the pensioners and a few of their backers and advocates felt like all they were getting was crickets. They went to then Governor Cuomo and said, you could find some money in the state budget and bail out. They couldn't even get a meeting with him. Some of the pensioners got together, tried to find a lawyer. And it wasn't till about 3 or 4 years where we were doing stories. And then Letitia James, the attorney general in New York State, got involved with it. She joined in the lawsuit. And then, as I said, I think that it's a sign that people in the community were reading the story. Eventually, a state senator, Jim Tedisco, got behind some kind of an effort and supported their effort to get their pensions back. And Assemblyman Santa Barbara also did. So I just think it's a good sign that we knew people were reading it because we got a lot of letters to the editor about it over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I really applaud you for sticking with that story. This is what local journalism is all about and why it's so important. And yes, other media entities might cover that. I remember being at the Saratoga, and nothing could be more useful to our readers than for us to be producing news of local impact. And then the Times Union would swoop in to cover it as a one-shot, cherry-picked issue, and they would do a very good job on it. Well, we've been investing, you know, day after day on the routine coverage, and so there was that sometimes frustration. Hey, this is our story, but you stuck with it. There's also the times when what was happening at St. Clair's is one example of a much bigger, broader, statewide or national story. And the New York Times, any big paper, could pick that as an example to serve in a story about the broader issue. But still, for the people in your community, what you covered made a difference. And that's how people would know to get involved.
I think a lot of times the big stories that the New York Times does, or ProPublica, Washington Post, the New York Times magazine section, many, many times those are stories that really small outlets started, really covered it. And, you know, often the big media, the Times Union or the New York Times, swoops in and, you know, they've got a very skilled journalist who they can do a really great job. But that foundational reporting that brings it to their attention, where they find out about some little tiny case on Long Island, is super important. I mean, the flip side of that is when we miss big stories, sometimes people say, where were the local media? But it's like the national media, you know, doesn't know about big stories unless the local media is doing sometime.
So. Sometimes it is the local stuff digging it out that creates a national storm. Think about PFAS, for example, pollution in our drinking water. That was really fundamentally a local story that has blown up into a big national story. Fracking was a story that actually began locally. I would say, honestly, in the Times Union was where it was first reported in this state, the concerns about that, and that became a big national story. And so these things are important, and you have another dynamic going on there in this case in St. Clair's, and that is pushback from the diocese. And that's been very tough. I mean, Judy and I were editors at a time when, you know, there was this first initial reporting about the priest sex abuse, and I'm sure you got, Judy, as I did, a lot of angry feedback from priests who would denounce us in the pulpit on Sunday mornings.
And, you know, the worst thing was, and we probably all feel this, is when someone calls you up and accuse you of getting it wrong or having bias. I mean, that's where you can really hit us in the heart. We can endure a lot of complaining and a lot of yelling and a lot of that. But when they say that we're getting it wrong, that's when editors really, really get upset. We don't want to get it wrong. And so, yeah, those were tough years, but you had to stick with the story. And it took so many twists and turns. The idea of sticking with the story, routine coverage, because you will hear people even in the newsroom say, oh, not another, you know, St. Clair story. And so people even within the newsroom will get tired of something. Sticking with something is something editors, I think that's part of your charge, is to keep at it. Oftentimes, a particular reporter will get invested with it, but in your case, this has gone on for 7 years. I bet it's gone through a few reporters.
It has, and the reporter did the lion's share of the work, which we eventually submitted for a Pulitzer. He didn't win one, but his work was excellent. He did a series of stories in 2018 and 2019. He's not with us anymore, so that is a problem.
That's him now.
He's calling. He wants back in, Miles. Actually, Barbara, to what you raised about the Pope calling for supporting the news media, we often are attacked for being anti-church, not just anti-Catholic Church, but for being against religion, we in the media. And it's actually really refreshing, isn't it, to actually hear someone from the church speak well of the media?
I find it encouraging. It's not a secret that statistically people who are in journalism tend not to be highly religious people or to even understand how religions work. In general, we're woefully uneducated about religion and don't tune into how much it is a part of people's lives. And I think that when we think about coverage of the Catholic Church, it tends to be about pedophiles and cover-ups. And there wasn't really that much, say, with Pope Francis. It seemed like it wasn't until he died that there was all this coverage about what a good guy he was about caring for the marginalized people.
It is hard in a newsroom to cover religion, I think, aside from the criminal part. The whole notion of religion is about belief in something that is not concrete, and journalism is about something that is concrete. And so for us to write about faith is very hard to do.
We've tried to cover the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church still has a very large presence in the Gazette readership area and the whole region here. We've tried to cover them from the standpoint that it is a huge community entity and that so many families, it's the basis for a lot of their social activities. But we've also tried, because we tend to get criticized either way. You cover the Catholics too much, you're too harsh with them. So when there's a story that they're going to close churches, we cover that. We had one recently about their latest announcement that they're potentially going to shut about a third of the parishes again, another round of this. But we also try to at least shine the light on them without bashing them. Every year, there's a handful of students from Bishop Gibbons Notre Dame High School in Schenectady, which is the lion's share of the families in that school are members of the Catholic churches in Schenectady. Every year they send a bus down to the March for Life down in Washington, D.C., which is this march which is against abortion, against legalized abortion. And we try to cover it. And a lot of times after we do that, it's usually on a Friday and the story's in a Saturday. And I'll get calls every time saying, why are you giving them any attention? Is this a stance that you are anti-abortion? No, it's not. In our coverage, we're trying to cover that discussion, that issue on both sides, because it's a complicated issue. So we just try to shine a light that this is a segment of our community and here's how they feel about things.
And given the size of the Catholic community, there's a lot of political angles to this story of the ultra-conservative Catholics versus the more liberal Catholics and their attitudes. Well, Francis and now Leo have had a go with J.D. Vance versus Trump. And So there's not one blanket type of person of any religion.
But few reporters have the capacity, the interest, or the understanding to be able to write about religion thoughtfully. It is a really tough beat to have. So much so that in my case, I actually basically turned it over to people of faith themselves. We always had a page called Faith and Values in the Times Union.
Our Saturday columns.
Saturday, absolutely. I give a Saturday column to different people who have these points of view and can write about them and then do a nice centerpiece photograph of churches, you know, places of faith. And that kind of would acquit us of the need to cover this without trying to stress a reporter into covering something that we don't really know that much about.
We don't have a dedicated religion reporter anymore. And we did have somebody that it was part of his beat and he retired. But we do have a dedicated religion notes page. So every Saturday in all the five papers, we have almost an entire page of events going on at local churches, synagogues, and it's in high demand. We get a lot of submissions, and goodness forbid that we forget to run that page sometimes, or if it gets bumped because of legals, we hear about it in a big way.
Just take note of the fact that you just said goodness forbid rather than invoke the Almighty. Not in terms of religious coverage. That's Miles Reed, editor of the Daily Gazette. Barbara Lombardo is here, formerly editor of the Saratogian, and Judy Patrick, the former Gazette editor, who wants to talk about the book about Joe Biden and what the implications of that are for journalism.
Yeah, this book is called Original Sin. It's by Jake Tapper of CNN and Alex Thompson of Axios. They interviewed 200 people, a lot of them off the record, talking about the decline in Joe Biden in the couple of years before the election. And their position is that the public did not know the severity of his decline. Now, there are bits and pieces of this coming out. The full book hasn't come out yet, but The question is, did the Washington press corps, did we believe too willingly what the administration officials were telling us was that, you know, President Biden was fine. He was just, you know, old. He gets tired, but he's fine. So did we miss that? And the other issue, should they have written the book? Of course, they should have written the book. I think some people on the left will say, you know, this is a disservice to the former president. The other thing I can just say, CNN has been, you know, milking this story for all it's worth with dribs and drabs. You know, just tell us what's in the book. Don't do a little bit every day. I know that's how television works, but there's that.
Well, what I read about the book, I only know from about
the dribs,
book,
and
from
drabs.
The dribs and drabs that I've read
right.
about the book. And one of the things that I read was that it really wasn't telling us anything that we didn't already know, but that it raises the question of how did the media handle it? And I'd say horribly.
Well, wouldn't the first question, though, be what did the media know and when did it know it?
Maybe, but there's things that good reporters should have known.
And shouldn't the White House aides themselves also have known? The dribs and drabs that I've read suggest that a lot of people, even within the White House, were shielded from the reality of Joe Biden's decline. And of course, it's a tough issue to broach. How do you deal with someone without immediately seeming to be biased about your coverage?
Yes, and concurrently, you had a candidate for president, who's now president, who would say one wackadoodle thing after another, who could not make a cogent sentence, who was making up stuff, who tells lies. So it almost seems a little icky to be picking on the person who still has some integrity.
But in retrospect, candidate Trump was saying, and what the far-right media was saying about the president's decline, in some respects, they were right. Too many people were too eager to say, no, they're just being partisan. And we should have taken greater alarm at the fact that he wasn't doing press conferences, that he wasn't doing the Super Bowl interview, that he was not having regular cabinet meetings. Those questions were being raised, but it just underscores for me the importance of transparency, of a president being out there, of doing the long form interviews with the New York Times or the Atlantic, or, you know, and doing more than just shouting as he enters the helicopter space. So some of it was reported, but maybe we should have pressed a lot harder.
Yeah. The problem, too, is that when initially, as soon as Joe Biden took office, even before, even as he was running, the right-wing politicians and their press corps, that would be Fox News and so on, were already saying, oh, he's too old, he's diminished, when there were no signs of it at that time during the campaign. So that when there really were signs, it was almost like the boy who cried wolf. You know, that your tendency is not to give in to it, but it became true, clearly, according to this book. What was said early on became reality eventually, and we in the media share the responsibility for not actually calling it out.
I think the media did miss the boat on this, unfortunately. But I think it's a reminder, it's an example of the tricky territory that journalists get into, you know, local ones, national ones, that there's some subjects, whether it's mental health or divorce or, you know, certain issues that we find out about with a politician or a business leader. And then there's that ethical decision, like, should we cover it? Should we not cover it? And we had not had a case as a national media with this kind of issue because, I mean, it's potentially discriminatory to raise the issue that somebody is not capable of executing their job because of their age or some kind of condition. We had, I think, a similar but a little different case at the Gazette about 5 or 6 years ago. There was a politician who was going through a divorce, and I'd heard about it for months, and we just had done nothing about it. We said it wasn't relevant. But then at some point, the politician's spouse or estranged spouse put a political sign on their lawn for this candidate's opponent. And the phone just rang about people saying, what's going on with this? And the estranged spouse was campaigning actively for this other person. And in this town, it was all anybody could talk about. So I wrote a blog about it. We didn't run it in print. And we got a lot of criticism. So I don't know if it was the right thing to do. But I remember the candidate calling me and saying, I can't believe you did this. And so now, in my mind, the candidate ended up losing after being in office and being very influential. And so it's a tough one. In some ways, I'm throwing myself under the bus. But we try to do those stories when we think it's relevant to voters or other taxpayers. And in this case, it had a huge bearing on the race.
You know, one of the things this underscores, all of this underscores, that I think people sometimes don't understand, is that there is a lot of back and forth that we all go through in making some of these decisions in our own minds. And you apply the best ethical standards you can, knowing that you may be making a mistake. But sometimes when you decide to cover something like that, that is a very hot topic, you really worry, am I doing the right thing here? Because the consequences are out there. Once you put something into print or air it or put it online, you know there's going to be outfall.
Yeah. Just yesterday, I got together with the news editor, someone who was the news editor for several years at the paper. I probably haven't seen them in 15 years at least. And one of the things that he talked about, of course, we were talking about the media. One of the things he mentioned was that people don't realize how much angst and discussion and consideration is given to decisions on every level, what to cover, what word to use, the phrasing, how to put the sentence together, how to present the headline, where it goes on the page or online. We give a lot more thought to these decisions than people may realize.
So in the Biden case, we local journalists here were not engaged in that. But imagine if you were the president of CBS News, and I would think this would go up to a high level in these organizations where you have people sitting in the White House all the time. And I would be sure that reporters were thinking, why are we not seeing the president? What is there? Is there something going on here?
Right. And there were those questions raised, especially about the fact that there was a lack of press conferences. And I can remember complaining that, you know, I never thought that press conferences were that good anyway, that did anything for us. But in retrospect, if he had done the press conferences, we would have known. But I will say that even after that disastrous debate performance, there were journalists who were still saying, maybe it was just a bad one.
There was a governor of New York State who was supportive of him even after that.
That's
Kathy
right.
Hochul was. And then the lieutenant governor said it's time now for him to step back. So it's a tricky one. And as the book says, he had good days and bad days, which makes it even trickier for the media, because if you're on the, you know, the White House beat and you just see him in the good moments for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you say, I don't understand all this criticism. He seems pretty sharp, because that's the weird thing about dementia, is that it is not a straight line, right? It is back and forth, and it's a slow decline.
And even now, his spokesman makes the point, which could be perhaps uncontroverted, that there are no instances that have been cited of where the government of the United States failed to respond appropriately because the president was not fully up to his previous capacity.
You know, with Taffer's response to that, he hints of another drib or another drab. And so, again, the book hasn't come out yet, so we will see how culpable we all are.
One more topic that I want to get to before we leave all of this has to do with, let's call it the Fox News pipeline, someone whom we all know well because she was in New York State, Jeanine Pirro, former Westchester County DA, ran for Attorney General of New York State, is now stepping into a new role as acting U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, which is an important job in the U.S. Justice Department. But she has become the 23rd employee whom Donald Trump has tapped from Fox News to join his administration.
On a bright side, weren't you excited to see Cicely Strong back on SNL?
I was.
She was great.
Was.
You know, you got to wonder, Rupert Murdoch at one point has got to say, hey, he's raiding my workplace, you know?
I know.
Or that maybe this is the training site. I mean, local papers often are training sites for larger papers. Maybe this is the same thing. I mean, who's covering the weekend news anchor beat now that they've lost Pete Hegseth?
Pete Hegseth is running the Pentagon instead of reading the teleprompter.
Yeah, and they're all probably, I'm sure they're all taking substantial pay cuts when they move from Fox News to the public sector. But who's left to cover the news? There's nobody left.
There's always been a back and forth between media jobs and public service. You know, MSNBC has both the former communication director for George W. Bush and the former press secretary for Joe Biden now as anchors. And of course, ABC News has George Stephanopoulos, who used to be communication director for Bill Clinton. But this is unprecedented, I have to say, people going directly from an on-air slot on a Friday to a top government job on Monday.
The only exception to this, and I do have concerns that there's too much of this pipeline, that they have too many Fox folks, is that in this case, there actually might be an exception that justifies it, and that Pirro was a district attorney in Westchester. She was effective, whether you liked her or not. She was able to execute the job. So the argument that she's not qualified for it, I think that doesn't hold water, and we'll see what happens. But to me, this is the least problematic about some of the appointees of folks that really had no credentials for the job. That they were appointed
right. She does have credible legal credentials, but she also is an election denier. She got Fox, one of the people that got Fox in a lot of trouble for her insistence on telling the lies about the not stolen election.
$787 million worth of trouble for Fox and the lawsuit that and her lies supporting Donald Trump's lies led to some of that.
Aren't a lot of the cabinet members, a lot of appointees are election deniers?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, that's just a reality, unfortunately. It doesn't mean it's not distressing, but it happens.
Well, that's why we have journalism, to try to be the truth tellers here, folks. Sorry if that sounds self-serving, but that is the fact. And that's why we're here in the Media Project. And we hope you've appreciated the conversation here, folks. Miles Reed, Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We thank our producer, Dave Gustina, and we thank you for joining us. Hope to see you again next week on the Media Project.
It's wonderful to represent the globe. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian, and editor and Vice President of the Daily Gazette, Miles Reed. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the globe. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.